the organizers for this excellent workshop. I'm happy to have been invited. So I'm going to talk about these large NF beta functions that we'd heard so much about at this point. So this is the outline of my talk. So I'll go sort of make successively more complicated theories in this framework. So we'll just start out by sort of regular gauge fermion theories here, sort of have a bit of the introductions from Pascal and Planck's Mestre and see how that works to get a feel for it. And we'll extend it to semi-symbol gauge theories. And then finally, we'll take the step to full gauge Yukawa theories. So this talk will mainly be about sort of the computational framework, how this expansion actually works, and so to sort of get a bit of a feeling for it. And I'll also talk a bit about how this might be applied to asymptotic safety, but without actually presenting any concrete model. So this presentation is based on this paper I wrote with Nicola, Francesco, Shiwei, and Oleg, who's not here. So if I won't give too much sort of motivation for it, I'll rather just let the other talks we've had at this workshop speak for themselves. So there'll be a talk by Shiwei tomorrow, where he'll employ this framework. And of course, we saw Steve's talk yesterday, where he presented the sort of the asymptotically safe standard model, where this was also employed. So the whole idea behind this, where we try to extend it to the full Yukawa, gauge Yukawa theory, is essentially that if you have any realistic standard BSM model, it should employ both Yukawa and quartic couplings. So that's why it's important to extend the large NF results to these kind of models. And then finally, it's sort of nice to explore to be able to explore a limit of QFT and have sort of some results beyond the regular one or two loop perturbative results. So another example would be sort of the Litum-Sannino model, where we have like a large number of flavors and a large number of colors. So this is just with a large number of flavors, but there's still a lot of particles going around. Very simply, I mean, the very simple model we can start with is just sort of a regular gauge theory here with a large number of vector-like fermions. So we'll have NF of those. And the question is then, I mean, how do we actually do this large NF expansion? Well, we'll have to introduce some sort of Zuhoff-like coupling. So we define this rescaled gauge coupling. So it'll go as G squared times the number of flavors. And then in the large NF limit, we'll keep that K constant. And that's essentially just to avoid, the more complicated loop structures we have, the more fermion loops and the more powers of NF we'll have. So if you don't have, keep this ratio constant, this product constant, then we'll run into problems. So to actually see what sort of diagrams will contribute in a given order, this is a simple observation that whenever we have a fermion loop, it'll count with an NF symbol because of the trace. And for each insertion, gauge insertion we have on this line, we'll get a power of G. So this whole fermion loop will contribute with a N minus 2 half of 1 over NF. So what we can derive from that is essentially that, if we have loops with just two gauge insertions, then they're sort of free from the perspective of the large NF expansion. So it means that we can, whenever we have an internal gauge line, we can just put a bubble on the gauge line and it'll still keep to the same order in the 1 over NF. So whenever we have an internal gauge line, we should just put every possible number of loops and then sum every such diagram in the very end. And as a contrast to that, then whenever we have a free or more gauge couplings in the same fermion loops, then it'll decrease the order in 1 over NF. So with this, we can start with the QED beta function. So the very simplest diagram we can have is just the fermion loop on the gauge line, which contributes the leading order beta function, just going as k squared. So this is the one loop QED result written in terms of this rescaled coupling. So there's not a lot going on here, but sort of the great breakthrough by Planck's Mester and Pascal was essentially to look at the next to leading order. And the next leading order just consists of these two diagrams. So the outer gauge loop here, fermion loop here, has four gauge insertions, so that decreases the order of NF by one. And now this internal gauge line will have every number of bubbles on it. So there'll be the diagram with one bubble, the diagram with two bubbles, and so on and so forth. And there are two different diagram sort of topologies contributing here. And one can then show that if we sum all of these bubbles, then we get a beta function that looks like this. So we have this 1 over nf that's been shown before. And you can express this function is given as the integral of another function itself. So we end up with this sort of quite complicated expression for the beta function. So the interesting thing that people have been pointing out here, and what's interesting from the perspective of safety, is that this function has a pole. So now I just sort of colored all of this blue. And this contribution here, this sort of gamma structure, is actually just what comes from one of these bubbles here. So you can trace it all the way back to this one bubble. And in the end, it means that this F1 has a pole at k equals 15.5. So we'll have, all right, so I'll return to that in a little bit. Then the next step we'll go to is the non-abelian case, because, well, most realistic models will have some non-abelian gauge groups, so it's, of course, interesting to see what happens there. The only thing is that our gauge coupling here will be rescaled further by essentially the Dynkin index, which also comes from the bubble of fermions. Whenever you have a bubble of fermions, you'll also get the Dynkin index. And then it was shown by, I think the original result was due to Gracie, but Holden sort of made it more readable for humans, if I can say that. I at least could understand Holden. So essentially showed, I mean, it looks a bit like the same. We still have this leading order beta function, which just looks like the abelian case. And then we have this new function H1. And once again, I mean, there's this result which just comes from the leading order bubble self-interacting just with gluon lines. And then we have this F tilde function from before, which is due to the sort of the abelian part of the diagram. And then we have this new contribution here. And that's essentially due to the non-abelian part and due to the gauge self-interaction. And once again, we have a pole here, but we see that this time, rather than just have the pole of F, we actually encounter a pole sooner here. So the pole is actually already encountered at k equals 3. So that's sort of the main difference between the abelian and the non-abelian case.
So that's the technical thing.
Yeah.
So is there some reason why it's useful to absorb the Dynkin index into the definition of k? Like, I would have thought you would leave k alone and then just put S2 where needed.
Right. So the main thing is that this summation comes essentially from power series in k. And it comes in the power series of essentially this whole collection.
S2 powers.
Right. Yeah. They enter just the same as NF. So it's just a matter of convenience. Otherwise, I'd have to put S here and here.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah. So this is essentially what the functions look like. So we can see these are sort of resummed functions that are sort of very well behaved. And then at some point, they encounter a pole. And this is, of course, what allows this to at least give a zero of the beta function. So this is what sort of suggests that there might be a fixed point of the beta function. And of course, it's necessary for there to actually be a pole, because otherwise, well, we could just increase NF to the point where it would die away. All right, so enjoy this slide. It's full of colors. The question is, of course, whether...
Can you go back? What is the one on the right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, so this is the non-abelian function. So this is this H1. Whereas this one is the abelian F1.
So the right one doesn't have it.
It also has a pole. The pole just happens at 3 rather than at 7.5 over here. The function looks a bit different. It depends on sort of the Casimir operators of the fermion representation here. So this is just for the fundamentals of issue 3. But qualitatively, it always looks like this.
I see. So the S1 and F.
Right. I guess that should have been extended down there. Thank you, mathematics.
Before one, so I think it looks like 3 poles, but why you take only one?
Oh, I mean, so this is the first pole.
Ah, okay, so.
I think there will be more poles filled out, yeah. But I mean, usually you just work in sort of the first cut. I mean, in principle, you could probably have a theory between 2 poles in this function. All right.
Question.
Yep.
So the pole doesn't translate into a divergent critical exponent?
I think it will. I think it will.
So then, how do you know that additional couplings will not become relevant at the fixed point? For instance, for fermion interactions, they're also fed by a fermion loop, so they will have non-trivial beta functions in the large NF limit. Their power counting irrelevant, but if you have a divergent critical exponent, then these things could be shifted into relevance and change the picture?
I don't know the answer to that. I haven't looked at it.
The thing is that, for example, would be the F squared, right, that you worried about, because that would be the derivative of the function.
No, so I'm just saying, if this critical exponent for the marginal coupling becomes divergent,
yes,
then that just means that critical exponents,
yeah,
deviate very far from canonical scaling.
Mm-hmm.
And so then operators that are canonically irrelevant, mm-hmm, could become relevant at this fixed point. This is why I'm asking.
But we have a computation of the F squared,
yeah,
anomalous dimension that seems not to blow up. We haven't applied it to this contest yet. But I mean, the point is that here you cannot identify the derivative of the beta function with the operator that drives the flow. Because at this fixed point, you cannot expand around. You cannot apply conformal perturbation theory because this happens so abruptly, right? Yes.
Okay, so the critical exponent that I would derive from the beta function would actually not tell me something about the scaling.
I would say no.
Okay.
No, but you could think of it as when you usually have infinite order phase transitions. They also exist, so basically a very exponentially fast exponents. So I would say I would more be worried. So it's not the scaling exponent, but you can calculate other scales. Those are fine. Those are powerful. Except for the.
Right. I think we should definitely discuss this afterwards because it is sort of an interesting discussion, and I really don't know all the answers to it. So just to briefly sum up, because Francesco and Oleg also did some work on this, and they were actually looking at this, at least the anomalous dimension for the fermion mass. And you could also see that the abelian fixed point here, the anomalous dimension goes to infinity, which might sort of suggest that fixed point is not really good. But for the non-abelian, that goes to 0 at least, so that seems to be nice. You should also see, I mean, they also argued that essentially the F1 function might be less. I mean, the power series had worse convergence than for the H1 function. So in sort of just to conclude on it, they were basically saying that probably shouldn't trust the abelian fixed point here. Then non-abelian, that's sort of a bit of an open question. All right, but I think I'll carry on to the semi-symbol part because, of course, the standard model is a semi-symbol gauge theory. So it's interesting to see what happens if we charge the our fermions here under some product of gauge groups. So the thing we should do is then we define sort of the total number of fermions, you could think of it, this capital N. And our k's for each gauge group is then given in terms of the relevant gauge coupling. And then N divided by the dimension of that representation is essentially the effective number of flavors from the perspective of that gauge group. So it's essentially saying we count all the fermions and all the other gauge groups. All right. Now, if we do that, then we can ask what happens with the mixed contributions to the firm, to the gauge beta functions. Well, it's sort of, in order to have mixed contributions, we sort of need one fermion loop to couple to two different gauge groups. So something like this, where we have externally one gauge group, and then internally in the loop, we'll have another gauge group, or gauge line propagate here. And they won't mix in these bubbles, simply because they'll trace out generators. So it turns out that it's only sort of these abelian diagrams that actually contribute mixed between the two gauge groups. So we just take the abelian contribution to the resummed beta function, and we replace this group factor we get from the outer loop here, it's g to the fourth nf, and replace it with g squared from one gauge group and g squared from the other gauge group, and then the trace of all the generators. So doing that, we essentially find that the total beta function for mixed includes this mixed term here. So to say, if we have the beta function for some group alpha, then contains the sum of contributions from all the other gauge groups. And since they come from these abelian diagrams, then we'll find that they actually contribute with this F1 term. So essentially, this means that as long as we would only have abelian, at least if we only have non-abelian gauge group, then all of these Fs are far away from poles, and they just contribute a very little bit to our beta function, but shouldn't change the overall flow towards the zero. And in fact, we tried to sketch this. So here we have an example of a fermion charge on an abelian and a non-abelian. And we see that essentially every flow from the Gaussian flows to this one fixed point in the UV, which is essentially located just at the poles of both the abelian and the non-abelian gauge group here. So it doesn't really change the flow much. So that's kind of nice. We can have semisimple gauge groups without sort of disturbing this flow. And we can also have two non-abelian groups. And again, this sort of the pattern holds. So this is, of course, sort of a very nice conclusion if we want to model build with this framework. All right. So the last thing we're sort of looking at and is essentially what happens if we have a full general quantum field theory. So if in addition to these NF vector-like fermion, we now have some wild spinners. We don't care how they're combined into Dirac spinners or Majorana. And we have some real scalars. Again, these could also just be put together into complex scalars if you prefer that. But this is sort of the most general way you can do it. The only thing we care about is essentially that we have many more fermions up here than we have fermions and scalars here. So that only the vector-like fermions really matter from the perspective of the large NF expansion. So this is of the most general Lagrangian we can write in this framework. So we have the Yukawa coupling, we have a quartic coupling, in addition to the gauge coupling. And now we can essentially, and I should say, well, in order for sort of the perturbative counting to be under control, in order to ensure we only have to care about the most simple gauge correction we can essentially have to each of these couplings, it requires that we count the Yukawa and the quartic coupling as if they're sufficiently small, just as the gauge coupling. So we require those to scale as 1 over n, otherwise you presumably need to have higher order loop corrections to these factors as well. But that's a bit beyond what we did here. So just, I don't know how am I looking for time, 15 minutes or so. All right. So within this framework we now set up, so just to very briefly say that this whole thing rests essentially on this sort of propagator for the photon. So we have all these bubbles summing on a gauge line. And we all know we can resum this sort of, or we can sum up all these contributions and just have something that looks like n. Oh, and I guess I said that completely wrong. We don't sum it up, we just multiply all these contributions together and get this sort of n, this sort of factor to the n, where this is just sort of the single bubble contribution to this propagator. So we multiply all these together, we find that a propagator with n bubbles have this form, and this is just the single bubble contribution to the gauge propagator. And the interesting part here is that, of course, we get this this coupling K, basically by design of the coupling K, contains the number of fermions in each bubble, and the gauge couplings to the bubble. And well, this factor here is just some dimensional function that comes from doing the loop integral. And now this thing here is actually the most important thing for this whole expansion. Or at least it sort of ends up being the most important thing, because it seems it's the inverse of this factor that actually shows up in all our beta functions. So we'll actually find that sort of the inverse of this, and then with a 2/3 k show up in all our beta function. And this is what gives sort of all the beta functions. I mean, we already saw it for the abelian and the non-abelian beta functions, that they have a pole at 15/2. And that turns out to also be the case for all the other beta functions. I'll go back to that in a bit, but just keep that in mind. To see how this works, let's just take sort of the fermion self-energy as an example, because we need essentially the fermion wave function renormalization in order to compute the beta functions. So what we actually do sort of very practically, we compute this sort of diagram by every possible number of bubbles. And as you can see, this is actually looks very much like a one loop integral. The only thing is that we have this sort of propagator here, rather than just the regular gauge propagator. So that only means that we change sort of the exponent of one of the propagators in the integral, and this is just, I mean, there are closed forms expression for these sort of integrals. So it's actually just plugging that in. And then we find sort of this result for the derivative of the fermion self-energy. So this is what you get once you sum up over all our n contributions with different bubbles. You get some power series in K, and you get this sort of a function here which depends on the number of bubbles and the dimension we're working in. And the only thing is that we factored out sort of an n and an epsilon n here so that this function is regular. And the reason for that is that if you do that, then you can actually resum this entire thing, and you can extract the one over epsilon pole, which is required for the beta function. And well, essentially this trick is due to, again, to Planck's Mestre and Pascal. I mean, the resummations differ slightly from the different beta functions, but sort of the overall idea is the same. And it should also be noticed that we sort of have the bare coupling K naught in here, which needs to be renormalized itself, which can happen to the leading order in one over n, just like this. So once all of this is done, we end up with a sort of a very nice and simple result here, except for this integral over function h naught. And this h naught itself is just somehow a collection of, well, our one bubble contribution here. Once again, these three gamma functions appearing. And then there's some other factor out here, which essentially depends on the overall loop here. So that's essentially what makes up this H0 function. And this H0 function is very persistent, because if we do this exactly the same thing for the scalar, we'll find that once again, we have this H0 appearing here once we extract the one over epsilon pole. Everything else looks more or less the same. We have some other group factors because we're working with the scalars, but other than that, it's just the same thing. Except there's an X up here and not an X here. And that's basically just due to, I mean, the Feynman integral being slightly different here than here, because this is fermions and this is scalars. So there's not really much magic to it. So with all of this now, we essentially have the Yukawa beta function. We just need to figure out the vertex correction, which is done here. Turns out this is the only diagram that contributes in the Landau gauge, because if you have the this gauge line connecting to the scalar leg rather than the fermion leg, then goes to zero in the limit of zero external momenta. And once again, this gives us this function h naught. So we can take all of this, put it together, and this is the full beta function for the Yukawa. So you can see this just contains the regular one loop result here, and then so the one loop, the gauge corrections here and here, which have been resummed. All right, so how does this look then for the abelian and the non-abelian case? Well, if one of these gauge groups are abelian, well then then we know k, the k basically goes to 15.5 because that's where the pole is. But this function h naught itself has a pole at 15.5. So it means that this, both of these terms become very large and negative. So they'll basically drive the Yukawa coupling down, but they're also proportional to the Yukawa couplings. So that'll essentially force Yukawa to be free. So that's not really a problem, but it's just to say that's basically the only solution once one of these is abelian. On the other hand, if they're all non-abelian, then we can see that, well, these terms, well, they're negative, but they're finite because h naught of 2 essentially is a positive number. So we get these sort of constant terms, more or less, that are negative, and then we can essentially just find some Yukawa coupling to give us a zero here. So to conclude, I mean, if we have sort of a non-abelian, if all our beta functions are if all our gauge groups are non-abelian, then we can have a fixed point here. It's also possible that it just drive it to a free in the UV. All right, so that was for the Yukawa. For the quartic, it's sort of more or less the same. The only thing is that now our vertex contribution looks something like this. So we have two different gauge lines. Oh, and it should also be said, I don't want to leave it out, that Alberto also did this computation basically at the same time as us, actually slightly before us. So so credit where credit is due. Well, essentially, now we have different places where we can place the bubbles. So the only thing that matters when we take the zero external momentum limit is essentially the total number of bubbles. So we just have to count how many times we can insert, how many distinct ways we can insert the bubbles onto these two gauge lines. And we'll essentially find that the diagram within bubbles, or the sum of all the diagrams within bubbles, just depends on k to the n plus 2, then an n, because there are n different ways to insert the bubbles, and then some function of n and epsilon. And well, once again, we can resum that, get this function h naught with some new polynomial of k in front of it. And
just for one gauge group factor, right?
This is done with just one gauge group. The very next thing to do is to extend it to the semi-symbol. So we also have I mean, if we have semi-symbol gauge groups, then we can have the scalar lines coupled to two different gauge groups at the same time to give mixed contributions. We have computed also the mixed contribution. We have already the expressions, yes. So it looks essentially something like this. I mean, the issue is now it matters where we place the bubbles. Because if we place the bubble on one gauge line, we get one gauge factor. If we place it on the other, we get another gauge factor. So we end up getting some, I mean, the Feynman, the integral part is essentially still the same. So it's only that now we have a series of all the different ways to place these couplings. But we can essentially just, this is somehow a geometric series. So we can just sum it up and we get something that looks like this for every number n of total number of bubbles. And that gives us an expression that looks something like this. Once we sum it, it should mention that this is not singular. I mean, if the two couplings here get very close to each other, then the integral also only integrates over a very narrow interval. So it's never really singular, this thing. So it's well behaved. And then we get this awful expression for the Yukawa coupling, the quartic coupling. So again, we have the regular one loop here with the quartic couplings and Yukawas and mixed contributions here. And then all of these are resummed. This is leg corrections, where we have one factor of lambda. This is all the corrections with one gauge group, and this is the expressions with mixed gauge groups.
So the last two lines are the new
Yes.
With respect to what we did.
I think it's actually only this one that's.
Yeah.
That,
this is the mixed contribution.
This is the mixed contribution. Yes, with two different group factors. Yeah.
And it's in the paper.
It's in the paper, yes. Yes, that's correct. And right, and then we can also sort of go in and look at what happens with the polls. Well, I think Alberto, you also mentioned this in your talk, that essentially if we have an abelian factor somewhere here, then we get a poll here, and this is a quadratic poll, a second order poll, and it goes negative. So this whole thing will essentially force the Yukawa the quartic coupling to become exponentially large and negative. So that's a complete no-go. We cannot really build a stable theory out of that. So as long as if we want scalars in the theory, we're basically forced to abandon the abelian couplings here. On the other hand, we'll find that the non-abelian, as long as we only have non-abelian contributions, then we're fine. So one simple way to do it is just to put the Yukawas to zero, say they run asymptotically free, then we'll have one positive contribution from lambda squared, and then one will find that all these different gauge contributions, they all run negative, except for this one that's essentially zero, because k equals 3 makes this term vanish, and we're exponentially close to 3 in this case. So in conclusion, if we have this if we have just non-abelian fixed points, then it opens up for a fixed point also in the quartic coupling. All right, and I think that basically takes me to the end. So to conclude, we've shown that the zeros of the gauge beta function essentially persists also in semi-simple gauge theories. We've also shown that essentially, or I guess sort of elucidate that the same pole structure appears in all the different beta function, and it's due to this one loop bubble, fermion bubble on the gauge lines. And finally, we've basically shown that if we just have non-abelian gauge groups, then we have the possibility of having fixed points both for Yukawa and quartic couplings. So this sort of allows us to build safe theories. All right, and then I couldn't find a provocative statement to end my talk with, but I can end with a question. And it's a bit in line with what we've already have discussed before, but just to say it very explicitly, is there anything that can sort of convince people that the non-abelian, ignore that X, that the non-abelian fixed point is real? I mean, is there any other way than actually putting this to the lattice that would convince people? All right, and with that, I'd like to end my talk.
Questions? Are there any issues of scheme dependence that come into this?
I think essentially we arrived at the conclusion that the 1 over nf is scheme independent. I don't think that's true for the next order in nf. So we should basically be safe from that perspective. I think basically adapting some of the same arguments from the scheme independence of the leading order beta functions.
There's a paper by Schrock showing that in every loop order, the highest power coefficient in an F is a scheme independent, and we're summing exactly those. So.
Is there anything you can do with supersymmetry in this?
Supersymmetry. I think they were doing sort of the same calculation in supersymmetry, and they found something that looked a bit like the fixed point. But there was some argument why they didn't really believe it. I think it might have been because they violated some of this A function stuff. Essentially you could show with some of these very exact tools in SUSY that it wasn't allowed. So I think that's unfortunately a no-go.
Yeah, I was actually thinking whether the A theorem would help you with this type of thing.
Yeah. So I think
it might be that somehow.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, it would of course be nice if someone could actually do the 1 hour, the next order in this 1 hour in F, but that might be fairly difficult because it's sort of rather nice at the leading order. Everything looks like a one loop, so that sort of helps you a bit.
I mean, I suppose so. If you did it in supersymmetry, you could compare the anomalous dimensions and see if
right.
it checks out with the arc charges.
Right, right. I guess, I mean, it might be at least nice to sort of compute some of these derived quantities and see whether if they actually look well behaved. I mean, we know it's not a fixed point, but it could still be interesting to see. Yeah, I don't know, but I think for now, this is sort of an interesting tool for model building.
So can I ask, since you wanted to provoke us with your last statement.
Yeah, I don't really know if provoking was the right thing, but.
So can you say something about the lattice computation? Is that something that anybody's thought about?
I don't know. I honestly don't know if it's, to what extent it's possible to put it on the lattice, because it does require a very large number of fermions. So at least. That might be an issue for just.
I mean, usually, I mean, like three is much bigger than. I mean, I know people do. I mean, it doesn't have to be very large that people do that thing. But I mean, the issue is, I mean, I know you could do like asymptotically free theories. You could put them on the lattice. But if it's not asymptotically free, then is the problem is. I mean, there's a. I mean, when you put them on lattice, would it be a problem? Because it's not. Well, it's not a finite complement, right?
No, if you can do it, because like if I do the fourth theory, which is also not asymptotically free,
yeah.
You are able to prove that the if I do the fourth theory is actually a trivial theory, so you can put this theory. Too. So the way you do it is just you actually write your action. It's true that different from asymptotic freedom, where you actually can control the scaling in ultraviolet by matching onto perturbation theory, and that's. Why because of freedom is actually quote unquote easier to put in the lattice. Now you write your lattice action. Then you have the lattice spacing, which is now your technical cutoff. You actually study theory with a cutoff and you calculate infrared quantities. Then you try to send the cutoff to zero, and the infrared quantity, the ratio of two masses, needs to be in the scaling regime. That is truly has an ultraviolet fixed point, must actually meet an ultraviolet limit, which means that as you send the lattice spacing to zero, the masses you calculate become independent of the lattice spacing. And that's the case. The theory is at infinite volume, the theory is asymptotically simple. Or it has a UP completion. That is actually the, how would I call it? This is the constructive way of proving that the theory of the lattice is an ultraviolet fixed point.
Yeah.
As for your second question, how many flavors you can put? If your staggered fermions actually is very, you can reach a large number of flavors very easily. Because remember, you need you can easily simulate powers of four in number of flavors. So 4, 8, 12, 16. So actually, it's not hard to do the number of flavors in a lattice is actually just a number. So it really that's not the problem. There is a technical problem, which is related to the fact that the more fermions you have in a theory, the more you're sensitive to topological freezing. And that is where you could have a problem, because you won't be able so easily. So you need to demonstrate that you don't have topological freezing. As you know, I have a generic gauge theory as a topological sectors, and you need to sample equally all the topological sectors. So if you have a very large number of flavors, it's well known that typical topological freezing is harder to, because the fermions are the one that carry topological charge. So it's harder to actually exact. So you know, you can be in the sweet spot, which means, let's say that from this computation, we expect 40 flavors for two colors to be such that the theory is perhaps statistically safe. You won't do infinite number of flavors, because nobody's crazy enough to put flavors. But you can put 40 or 30 flavors on the lattice for an SU2. You can check whether this theory is safe or not. At the very beginning, and I say very beginning is 40 years typically, you will be studying the lattice action and will be studying basically whether you're doing it controllable, and then within 6-7 years you will average it in number that you can trust. But different from gravity, you can do it. The respectful life.
You can do it, or are you doing it?
Yeah, we're doing it.
Okay. And you say you're going to have answer in 6 years?
As I say, it takes basically 3 to 5 years. But it's an answerable question.
How many years from?
3 to 5. So you first have to study, actually. Lattice is like an experiment. You basically need to understand your lattice first. And then when you understood your lattice, you understand whether or not... So first you need to understand whether you're not discovering, in which phase you are, because on the lattice, you can have lattice artifacts, so you need to be able to make sure that those are not phase. The volume must be sufficiently large, but there is a plus here. Different from the infrared conformal window, I'm not interested about chiasymmetry. So I can just put the mass as large as you want for the fermions. So I don't have to make this, chiral. So with some fermions, I don't need to tune it.
So I guess one thing that puzzles me is that, I mean, you have this UV fixed plane and IR fixed plane,
yeah,
and there's one trajectory that goes from one to the other, but there are all these other trajectories that don't end up in the UV or IR fixed plane. I mean, you may start from UV fixed plane, but end up somewhere else.
No.
I mean, at least from... all these trajectories essentially go from the UV down to the IR.
It's a CAS.
As long as you're less than 3, I mean, if you're sort of on the right side of the pole, so basically we're probably only interested in the region sort of roughly. Yeah.
Which is very easy. You know where you want to be.
Okay.
It's going to be in 3D. And you do it.
Maybe I make a very small comment. It's if you are above 3, it's going to the second branch.
Right.
It's a different branch, depends different pole. So we are now basically focused on the first branch and the first pole.
Uh-huh. But you know where you're starting from, because you know it's not a billion QD infrared.
So
the
another way, potentially, if this fixed point is a conformal theory to study, it would be the conformal bootstrap. So can you say anything about whether this kind of principle be applied, or were there any obstructions to applying conformal bootstrap techniques?
I have no idea, to be honest.
Say it again?
The conformal bootstrap might be another way to...
Yeah, but we use it in people with oligantity, we use it.
Oh. Wait, boots?
Yeah, bootstrap.
No,
yeah,
wait,
that's
what?
Actually, yeah. Oh yeah, we called our Japanese colleague in Japan that had calculated indeed for exactly this theory for arbitrary NF the conformal bootstrap.
Mm-hmm.
So as usual, it's useless.
Okay.
A bound of the anomalous dimension of the quark mass. But when you bootstrap, it doesn't care whether it's safe or free. It's a conformal theory. So you have an SNF cross SNF symmetry, and you calculated the band on the smallest possible anomalous dimension, which is the same quantum number of cybersat. This number is 1. It must be less than 1. So this, the not particularly intelligent referee that had our paper didn't publish in PRL, I mean, he actually didn't realize that actually it was also bootstrap related to that. So that's actually the way it is. So it was too technical on the paper. Still? I don't know anyone has ever done that. So actually, we also compared it to the bootstrap. And all and behold, I was surprised to see that the anomalous dimension was indeed very tiny and completely compatible with that. So, no, at least from that point of view, I cannot exclude this possibility. I'm more worried, as Nicole and also Anna said, about the anomalous dimension associated to the skinning spawning of the whole.
So how large does NF have to be for this behavior to be?
So again, I'll refer to essentially Oleg was doing some, and I think maybe even Holden was doing, essentially trying to see at what point does the, because you can essentially look at the 5-loop beta function, which is known, and then you can look at, well, at what point do your leading order NF part of those 5 loops become larger than all the other orders. And you'll essentially end up having essentially something like 10 times the number of colors sort of as a rough estimate for this. So
tensor
in the fundamental representation, and then I think slightly less if it's in the anti-fundamental. Oh, sorry, if it's in the two index.
So just one other, I mean, you asked this one question, but is another question that maybe a lesson that seems to emerge from a lot of this is that abelian groups are to be avoided and that the real world theory ultimately has to be non-abelian and we get the U1 from symmetry breaking?
Right.
Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I mean, at least this, at least in this framework, you're not getting anywhere with the U1.
I agree. I think we can just seal the U1s forever.
Yeah. I think that sums it up great.
Either low and lambda flavors or large number flavors.
So also the mixed contribution for the gauge beta function is in the paper.
Yes. I mean, they are, I mean, it's essentially just this extra term you add here. And they all look sort of a bit, I mean, they all have this abelian function.
It's just, the dimension of the gauge.
Yeah, the dimension of the gauge here.
Times F1.
Yeah. And then you have this N, which is again this sort of part of all the dimensions here. So as long as none of these are abelian, they don't really matter. And you can see from this flow that it turns out they don't even matter if none of them is abelian.
So the count one is. It's the, your count one is just a simple case, or you do like the...
This one. This one would be the full Yukawa. And so there's no mixed contribution to Yukawa at this order. So you just get a sum over all the different gauge groups.
Ah, right.
So you just add them all together, essentially. So that's, of course, quite nice. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
At least from a computational viewpoint.
I may also say that the only thing that, I mean, the only limitation of this result is the fact that the scalars is one, or at least they're not scaling as an F. That's the
right.
Only, this beta function can be applied to any model that doesn't have scalar scaling with an F.
Doesn't have scalars?
Like an F, like the fermion. So only vector-like fermion scales like an F.
Well, I mean, to be fair, I mean, we don't couple the vector-like fermions with the Yukawa either. Because that could change. I mean, that would be a second resummation you'd have to do.
So one last thing.
No, actually, it's something which we thought would be interesting doing, but I think they would probably kill me.
No, it's fine.
It would be nice, for example, to all the stuff we've done with the scalars, right, inside that. The scalars were only coupled to a subsector of the flavors. Would be nice to see, imagine that since we know that there is a fixed point in perturbation theory in the theory with infinite number of flavors and infinite number of colors. If I now I reduce a number of colors, I could still do the larger net resummation. But it's more complicated because also scalars enter into the bubbles.
Yeah.
That has not been done. Because now we have a limit, so when since you asked the question, now you've put yourself to work to do. So we ask the question that, you know, can we, how can we prove that there is a fixed point? Let's start from a theory where the fixed point exists. The paper with the meeting, we have it, we've done it, we have it. So now ask yourself if you have a C fixed, a large enough, why can't we use a large enough computation to check what happened to the beta function and match it on to find a large C? It's more complicated.
Right.
No, because their X loops are no longer suppressed.
So in the large NC limit, you also make the large NF limit.
In the perturbative fixed point, we do it in the Veneziano limit, large N and large NF.
Yeah.
Now, in that theory, you can demonstrate there is an ultraviolet fixed point. Now I want to reduce the number of colors but keeps the number of flavors fine. The number of flavors is infinite,
yes.
But keeps the number of colors, so dropping the number of colors. So it should go over a theory like this, where it's a large NF resummation.
But then the fixed point that you prove that they're there, you're no longer...
It's no longer perturbative, but they should map into this other fixed point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's now a large NF finite NC. But different from these theories, you have to resound bubbles of Higgses.
Yeah, you have an F squared scalars in that theory.
That we can discuss. It would be great to actually
And we can discuss this in a coffee break. And we reconvene on 2-3, and let's thank Alice again.